is insane when you think of other schools in the region. And the culture at Western Dubuque is very, very different. I still work with Western Dubuque Community High School quite a bit, and a lot of the programming we do here through the River Museum. And there is a difference. You can see it, and it starts with the administrators and the teachers. They're the ones who build it, nurture it, maintain it, and to be honest, it's even a better place than it was when I was there.
I was amazed because, myself and other retired administrators and teachers, we were concerned about preserving what we had started. And about 3-4 years ago, we got invited back for a luncheon.
Yeah.
And we got to meet the new staff. Wow, I was so impressed. And so it's been carried on. And I honestly, if I was raising a new family, I couldn't think of a better place to do it.
Yeah, I consider myself a Western Dubuque legacy. You know, my whole, like, both sides of the family, parents, aunts, uncles. My dad's one of 11. They all went to West Dubuque. My mom's one of 6. 4 of them went to West Dubuque, and that's just because Grandma and Grandpa had to leave Farley and move to Dubuque for a couple of years. And Jeff, or Jody and John went to Wallert. My wife's family, however, are Wallert legacies. So Holy Family is the future for our kids. Yeah, I know. Holy Family is our kids' future. So that's where we're at right now, just because of where we live. We're just outside the city of Dubuque.
Where are you at?
We're in Barony Woods over by Derby Grange.
Right off JFK.
Yeah, right off JFK there.
Well, that's going to be an area that's developed, also being developed in the future, I think, right?
The city's growing around it, but they're not going to annex us anytime soon. We're a private well water, private septic, no city ordinances. We can just do whatever the heck we want. No housing, no HOA. It's kind of like a little outlaw neighborhood that's surrounded by the city of Dubuque, which I love.
Okay. I'd like to just begin with saying that, well, it's September 24th, 2021. We're talking with Jared McGovern. And Jared, I wonder if I could just begin with some memories you had of your early experiences in the West Dubuque system.
The West Dubuque system was the only system I knew until I was in college at Iowa State University. And, you know, some of my early experiences, I can remember back to going to Seton. I went to Seton, which became Seton, while I was in school, from kindergarten all the way through fifth grade, and then I went into the Western Dubuque Community Schools public school system in middle school from Drexler and then through WD. But I'll say one of the earliest memories is Sister Benjamin at St. Patrick's in Epworth. I went to her office every single week for behavioral check-ins when I was in like first and second grade. I pulled the fire alarm when I was in kindergarten. And as a kindergarten, you know, you look back and you're thinking, like, yeah, you hung on that thing because it's right at eye level. But no, I looked at it and I'm like, what the hell this does? And I just yanked it, and I knew I was in trouble, and I was. I remember in kindergarten learning early on that if you really fell asleep during the nap time, they wouldn't wake you up. And then they would just send you home with whatever activities there were in the afternoon. So that's back in the day when you just went to kindergarten every other day, right? So the milk jug snacks that came everywhere, warm fuzzies, the Guardian Angel program within Seton, I remember all of those very, very well. And, you know, just the friends that I met, the people that I grew up with from my time in kindergarten through high school, they're still my closest friends in the world. And that's one of the things that I can maybe trace back to Western Dubuque above anything else is the close friends that I made that are lifelong friends and now family. There was only one person in my wedding who was not a Western Dubuque graduate, and it was my wife's brother. Everyone else was a Western Dubuque grad, either a couple years older than me, the same age as me, my brother, who's 9 years younger than me. All of them were Western Dubuque graduates. All of my groomsmen, all of my ushers. And, you know, I I left Dubuque County for a long time. I lived in Pennsylvania. I lived in South Dakota. I lived in Texas. I went to Iowa State for 4 years. So I was out of Dubuque County for about 10 years or so. And okay. Still, those were the people that...
Back to the roots.
...are the ones that I care about the most. And I still do to this day. I ride Ragbri with like five of them on an annual basis. So
how about some of your let's say middle school teachers that are memorable?
Middle school teachers that are memorable. Kay McDermott. Kay McDermott's very memorable because of speech. You know, I identified early on that my interest in natural resources, animals, wildlife, you know, I kind of knew what I wanted to do from the time I was in elementary school. I wanted to work with wildlife. But in Kay's class, I really started becoming theatrical. Like, and I do that today. I'm a performer, right? I teach. I'm an educator, but I work at an aquarium, a museum, a science center where education and entertainment are not mutually exclusive. People come to these places to be entertained and educated. And so pantomime was amazing. You know, learning in that class the power of facial expressions, of body language, using your body to tell a story without having to use your voice. And then once I was at Iowa State, that kind of then transitioned into using inflection, positioning, place-based education, all of these different pieces. But, you know, sixth or seventh grade, one of the two. Yeah. Okay. She was a former sister, Mrs. Ungs. Phyllis Ungs as well. And I remember her very well because she had a camel poster in her room. An anti-smoking camel poster hanging on the wall. Joe Camel sitting there, but I remember that science class. Sandy Gassman, formerly Sandy Ross, very well. Mr. Snyder, who was obsessed with astronomy. Like I think in seventh grade we were probably supposed to cover other things rather than planets and solar power. But that's all I remember from that class. Eighth grade science.
Mr. Heyer?
Heyer, yes. Mr. Heyer, whose son actually worked with my mom for a while. But anyway, Trapper Keepers, back in the day when we used to use acids, and we were looking at acids and bases, and we started using the acids to burn holes through our Trapper Keepers. That was a lot of fun. That was very cool. But he was one of the more entertaining and engaging teachers that I've had, Mr. Heyer. And then the amount of Oregon Trail that I played in middle school in the technologies class was insane. Like, so much Oregon Trail. Yeah. Oh, and then Mr. Rickles in was that high school? That was high school.
Yeah.
That was high school, and that was computers class. And Miss Becker typing. You know, I really didn't think how useful that would be.
Yeah.
Dick Smith. You know, I'll never forget the ridiculous jokes, and I still see him around town to this day. You know, I know I've kind of gotten out of middle school a little bit, but
that's okay.
You know, enrichment seminar was a really amazing program that Western Dubuque held that Dick was the lead on, and you know, by my scores, I wasn't really supposed to be in that. I think I got special exemption because I had good grades and I did the work and everything, but that class was amazing. I read Origin of Species during that class. It took me like 3 months to do it because if you ever try to read Charles Darwin's work, it's madly confusing and he repeats himself all the time. But evolution, and that again reinforced my interest in natural history, sciences, and ultimately that's why I do what I do, is all of those different science classes. So that was, I jumped into middle school, but into high school, but yeah.
How about activities outside of class?
Cross country and track. I did 1 year of golf. I grew up in Thunder Hills, so you know you kind of have to try to golf. But then Steve Finley and Diane Finley were my next door neighbors, so it was only a matter of time before I was not a golfer and I was in track and field. And then working with Larry McCready when Hermie was our coach. I'll never forget running practices on the gravel roads, and you could hear his little gremlin or whatever that car was he drove. You could hear it coming over the hills, so you knew when to start running, which was awesome. But those, again, I commented on some of the closest friends that I've continued to have. Most of those guys were people that I ran track with and ran cross country with. Alex Deitmeyer, Adam Ross, Ben Grant, just to name a few. And I think one of the fondest memories of high school activities outside of class is when Ben won state cross country. He won it by a lot. that was a big deal to see him do that, because, you know, Ben's one of the best people I know, and to see him succeed like that was making me very, very happy.
Is that a Ford Dodge?
Yeah. He destroyed. I could not. He won by a full minute. Wow. It was insane. I couldn't believe how much he pulled away from the pack in like that last half mile or so. It was just gone.
Where's Ben now?
Ben's in Colorado now. He was in Pocatello, Idaho for 11 years after graduating from Loras. He was an All-American at Loras College, running cross-country and track. And then he got married back in June 2019. I was in the wedding. I was there in Idaho, in Pocatello. And then he and his wife moved to Greeley, Colorado. She works in sociology and researching traditionally male-dominated fields and how those fields can better accommodate females who are obviously interested and talented and want to get in fields such as agriculture or geology. Those are the two areas where her research is focused most heavily. And so he's in Greeley right now working from home doing traveling sales with big electrical transformer units. Okay. But his passion's skiing and mountain biking and camping. So that's what Ben's doing.
So you moved on. You had to make a choice as far as leaving West Dubuque and going. What were some of your choices, or how did you decide?
So I visited two colleges during that whole application process, and Winona was Winona State was more of a suitcase college, so I went up there on a weekend visit, and there was nobody there. I was like, no, I do not want this. I went to Iowa State University, and I looked into their animal ecology program, and I met with the advisor. I spoke with some of their professors, and I just made the decision I'm going to go to Iowa State. So I applied to one college. I got in. I took the ACTs three times, and I got the exact same score every single time. So I was like, okay, looks like I'm going to a state school. But yeah, I went to Iowa State. I was there for 4 years, majored in animal ecology with an option in environmental interpretation, environmental education, with a minor in cultural anthropology. And at that time, I thought I wanted to work for the National Park Service. Coming back to the city of Dubuque was never on my radar growing up, but the museum here opened in 2003 when I was a junior, and all of a sudden there was opportunity for me to return home. So I bounced a little bit. I worked in Pennsylvania for the Pocono Environmental Education Center, which is a nonprofit residential environmental ed center within a national recreation area, the Delaware Water Gap National Recreation Area on the tri-states of New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York.
You know, we were out there for just a trip and stayed in that area. Kind of an intriguing area.
I spent 9 months working with students from Bayonne, New Jersey, Camden, Philly, Newark, Delaware, Dover, and then New York. All the boroughs in New York were bringing students for 2 to 3 day experiences at this environmental ed center, and that was amazing. That experience is what solidified the direction that my career has gone since, working with students who, yeah, this was one of their first experiences in the wilderness or in green spaces, because environmentalism, conservation, parks. It's traditionally a pretty elitist and white field. They're hard to get to. You need to have reliable transportation to get to these protected spaces. So they're a little out of reach of students living in inner city communities like the ones that I was working with out in Pennsylvania. I swam to New Jersey like 5 times, which is pretty cool. I don't know how many people can say they've done that. At least in Dubuque, Iowa. Probably not very many. And then I went to South Dakota after that for the first full-time job and worked for Game Fish and Parks in Sioux Falls.
Okay.
And then I thought I wanted to get into formal education, so I came back to Dubuque and I started going to school at Clark for a summer. But while I was doing that, I was working part-time at the River Museum again. I interned here for 3 summers while I was at Iowa State. And then they had an opening, a full-time opening, and I was hired. So then I was here for 3 years and decided to move on and go work in Texas for the Texas Audubon Society.
Where was that at?
Dallas. Too big. I'm not a big city guy. No, Dallas was not for me. So I left Dallas, moved back to Dubuque, and I worked for the University of Wisconsin-Platteville in their continuing education department. And that was cool. I mean, I really enjoyed learning about their biology programs, their agriculture programs. They have an extremely talented group of professors at that organization. And one of the reasons I did leave is because it was cost prohibitive for us as a continuing education department to utilize that talent. And if you ask me, the greatest resource that any organization has, especially universities, are their professors, are their educators. That's where all your capital's at, is in those people. So River Museum has another opening about 6 years ago. Came back. At that time, I had started dating my now wife.
Okay.
And we're married now with 2 kids. And I'm in God's country, as Grandpa Bud would put it. So, yeah.
So talk a little bit more about your position here and what you've been involved with.
So I started here in the education department. When I came back in 2010, I was the science education coordinator. So I oversaw the science education programming, which at that time was mostly around natural resources, Mississippi River, freshwater. Then I transitioned into more of a partnership role. My title became education manager, programs manager, or something along those lines. And so the job didn't really change a whole lot. It's just that I took on a lot of the historic interpretation responsibilities on top of the science responsibilities. And then innovation and partnerships was the next iteration of my life in the education department. And then about 2.5 years ago, I started having conversations with our CEO, our now Vice President of Living Collections and Education, and other members of our team here at the museum about, you know, looking at what the River Museum's identity needs to become in the foreseeable future, the next 5 years, right? We are not a neutral entity. You know, the museum carried itself as Switzerland. You know, we're going to teach facts, and we're going to let you make up your own mind. Right? That whole, like, Fox News, we report, you decide.
Yeah.
We're a science organization. We're the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium, whose mission is to inspire stewardship through educational experiences. We are not neutral. When it comes to the protection and the stewardship of the Mississippi River, we are not neutral. Like, if you're presented with 2 options, the one that's going to protect the Mississippi River the most, that's the one that we're going to support and we're going to get behind. We also started looking at what zoos and aquariums are as conservation organizations beyond advocacy, beyond that, you know, non-neutrality mindset. And so we started looking at how we can get more involved in in-situ work. How can we get out in the community doing work in our own backyard? And then we looked at how are you going to change people's behaviors or inspire behavior change? Because ultimately, people are the problem when it comes to a lot of the environmental issues that the Mississippi River faces. But we're also the solution. Like, we are the only solution to the Mississippi River watershed health, water quality, biodiversity, climate change crises that we're all experiencing collectively right now. People are the solution. And how do you engage people in sustainable behavior change? You show them. You celebrate with them. You focus on successes and solutions as opposed to constantly using crises. crisis messaging. And so we designed and developed a department around that known as conservation programs. And so today my role revolves around issue-based and nonpartisan environmental advocacy, facilitating research opportunities. I work a lot with our local universities and with some of our federal and state partners, and then engaging the community directly in real in-situ conservation projects. The two major ones right now that we're working on are around water quality, specifically looking to decrease surface runoff and increase infiltration. So we work a lot with our local soil and water conservation districts and our Natural Resource Conservation Service and Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship, the DNR, and what have you in this region. And work with them on sharing their message and the work that they're doing. And then we work with the City of Dubuque, and we work with the Dubuque County Conservation Board and Iowa State Extension and Outreach, Master Gardeners, on urban habitat work and community resiliency to extreme flooding. So we're working with the Mowing to Monarchs program and Monarch Safe, where we head start wildflowers and native grasses that are then gifted to community members to start pollinator gardens in their yards. And then through that action, we're interpreting the benefits of using prairie strips as part of agricultural operations, or cover cropping, or riparian habitat. You know, all of those different messages can expand out of this, as well as connectivity and the importance of, you know, managing urban landscapes for healthy native insect populations, because that's the foundation. So you need to have host species as well. So you got to be very particular with the tree species that you add, and stop planting European or East Asian species that can survive here. You know, we do a lot of that in our landscaping work. And then the final one that we're currently involved in pretty heavily is mussel restoration, freshwater mussels. There's about, on the upper Mississippi River, you're going to be seeing about 41 species. Historically, there were about 53 or 55. In Iowa, like right here in Dubuque County, you could find upwards of 30 species here. Yeah. They're the most, we have the most biodiverse population of freshwater mussels in the world in North America. And we're working with the Army Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Geological Survey, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Genoa National Fish Hatchery, on mussel propagation. And then we work with area high schools, including Western Dubuque, engaging students in that wildlife management and wildlife conservation project.
Have you gone out into the high schools and done presentations?
You know, I prefer to get the high schools, not even to us. Just to, you know, we do have a lot of high schools that come to the River Museum to experience this work firsthand, because we do some of it on our campus. Like, we have our greenhouse on our campus. That's where we head start our pollinator plants. And we have our lower dock on the ice harbor, which is where we grow out the freshwater mussels and where that project is currently headquartered. And so we engage students with that. We bring high schools here from Wisconsin, all across Dubuque County. And then my favorite part, though, is when we can get those students out in the field doing the work as opposed to just learning about it.
Yeah.
And we do that with WD Service Day, which is amazing. I wish they had that when I was in high school. They didn't. And that's one of the coolest things, I think,
Is that going on right now, or it's the
29th. It's next week.
Yeah, so I thought.
So I'm going to have 25 students here who are going to be working on the mussels and prepping the greenhouse so that we can get the seeds stratified and prepped for January. We'll have 50 working with the City of Dubuque and the Dubuque Metropolitan Area Solid Waste Agency on trash cleanups in the Lower B Branch, which is a 100% urban watershed, about 6.5 square miles in Dubuque. And then there's a lot of students that are going to be working with the Dubuque County Conservation Board on invasives work, seed collecting work to support the Mowing to Monarchs program, and I think they'll be doing some trash cleanup and some tree maintenance work too with the county on the 29th. Yeah.
I've been trying to do some work. I have a lot of history background, and I always, whenever I hear the whistle of the Illinois, used to be the Illinois Central, it's now the Canadian going through, and realizing that roadbed was constructed right after the Civil War, and basically I've been trying to get the tunnel reopened.
Yep.
Without success, but I'm still going to keep trying to get it happening.
With how much Piasta and that area is growing, I mean, maybe the county will eventually want to open up another access point.
That's exactly the right.
There's developments now off Old Highway, just outside of Centralia. There's developments that are now between 20 and Old Highway from Piasta. Like, the whole thing has been developed, as you know.
If you don't have access to Highway 20 on Thunder Hills Road, mm-hmm. there's no other place to go, basically. So.
And Thunder's connected to Piasta now, basically. So it's, you know.
Yeah. Anyway, that's been, and then I've been working with the city a little bit to try to get some planning going as far as the interchanges at Thunder Hills Road and Cox Springs Road, which are obviously very dangerous.
Yeah, they're putting all that money in right now for the Swiss Valley Road and the area right in front of the truck stop, but then you get to Cox Springs and you're like, oh. So people can just come out here now instead. All right. Or the speed limit's faster than 55. It's 65.
Yeah, because when you're coming on Highway 20 going west past the truck stop, you're basically going downhill, and you're picking up 75 miles an hour, 80 miles an hour for that intersection of Thunder Hills. There's going to be some real serious incidents.
Thunder Hills has always been a dangerous intersection. You know, we're lucky that there hasn't been, at least in my time, any like serious accidents with classmates or anything like that.
Yeah, plus, the buses use it too, so.
God, my bus used to go through that tunnel.
I know.
We used to scream every time we'd go underneath of the thing as loud as we could. And that was because, I guess, at the time you couldn't make left turns across two lanes in the buses, so they would take the loop. But I'll tell you that one of my not fond memories of Western Dubuque is the amount of time that I had to spend on a school bus, because the district is so big. Like, I was on that thing for probably 45 minutes in the morning and over an hour in the afternoon every single day.
How about, you know, when you drive up through the district, how about when you get out toward Luxembourg? And I remember kids I had at the high school involved in activities living north of Luxembourg. I mean, that's like 25 miles.
When I was in second or first grade is when Bankston Elementary closed. Right. And that's when those students came in. And then it was such an odd experience, you know, having gone to school with the same people, basically, whether they went to Seton or they went to Drexler, all the way through high school. And then all of a sudden, RHCL comes in. You're like, I didn't know you guys existed. Where did you come from? But then the Langles and the Foxons and the Youngses and the Schillings and the Ramblers, you're like, they're great friends to this day, too.
You know, the same thing happened in, I think it was 1990, when Leo High School closed. We got a lot of those students that came in. And a lot of very nice people.
Yeah, it was awesome. I mean, that was, most of the people that ended up coming in, a lot of those guys were part of our state track team and basketball teams and state football championship. And
yeah.
They were all part of those, so that was pretty cool.
You know, anyway. It's so ironic, I guess, in a way, when I opened up the sports page and West Dubuque is kicking butt in just about everything.
Yeah, there's a lot of talent coming in. The school's much bigger. The coaching is phenomenal. And you got coaches that are dedicated, because a lot of the coaches are former students.
Yeah.
And that's huge. A lot of the coaches who, you know, Mike Elgin, for instance, right? I mean, who else would you want as a football coach than Mike Elgin? I don't know if you could think of a better football coach to come back to Western Dubuque and coach that team in the capacity that he does.
I interviewed Mike, and I enjoyed the visit. But I remember him talking about when he was actually playing for the Hawkeyes, and he said you would notice it in the game. He said, and eventually after the second half would begin, the other team would begin to sag a little bit, lose a little bit, and we would gain. As he said, that's our secret.
They were always a second half team, and it's because their line is amazing. They always focus on the offensive and defensive line.
Right. Yeah.
That's the secret sauce of Iowa Hawkeye offense and defense is their line.
You know, I could care less as far as Iowa Hawkeyes being national champions or whatever, because along with that goes a lot of stuff that's not very, very nice.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm happy that they are doing what they are doing.
I just thought it was crazy seeing, because I ran, Mike ran, he was on the basketball team when I was on the JV team, and then he was also running track at the same time that I was. And I'll never forget him coming back after, I think it was his first semester at Iowa, and it wasn't the same body. Like, it was, and he could still dunk. And I was like, how can you still jump this high? You put on like 70 pounds. Come on, man. What the hell? But yeah, Mike and his family, back to high school and back to teachers, the psychology class was one of my favorite non-science classes. And Mr. Elgin in that class was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed psychology. It's all about communication sciences. And ultimately, that's what my master's ended up being in, is organizational leadership and change theory from Clark University. So, psychology, anthropology, human behavior, sociology. One of my passions now is combining and making sure that human component of conservation design is a priority in everything that we do. You know, people are always going to be the focal point, if not one of the focal points, in any conservation project that we design. And that's kind of best practice now in the field. That's the direction that the field is evolving. Social sciences and conservation sciences are allies. So,
said you did you do a presentation last night someplace? Or
Tri-State Trail Vision. I was on their Zoom call last night. I worked with the Franciscans yesterday too, I think. I don't know, the Franciscan way is pretty cool. My Aunt Lori runs the Canticle for Creation Center. And St. Francis was always about stewarding the land and caring for the land. And if you read the Bible, they call for the land is for people. But I interpret that as it's our responsibility to care for the resource. And that's how the Franciscans approach their work. So they're really cool to work with. But right now I'm working as part of a bond referendum committee in the county. The Board of Supervisors were petitioned by the County Conservation Board to leverage a $40 million bond referendum on the county to invest in trails, outdoor recreation, maintenance and improvements on existing property, land acquisition, strategic land acquisition, and we're hopeful. The Board of Supervisors has set that referendum date for November 2nd, so it's going to be on the ballot here in about 6 weeks. And from the start, I've been representing the River Museum on the Dubuque County Land and Water Legacy referendum, bond committee, where we are working to get the yes vote. So we're fundraising right now. We're targeting likely voters, making sure that they know when they come to the polls that, this is what this is. The worst thing you can do when you're trying to pass something like this for the good of the community, because this is going to lead to all sorts of different things. It's not just for outdoor recreational pursuits. It's not just for clean water. It's not just for flood mitigation. This is for quality of life, human health, economic vitality, maintaining talent in the manufacturing and in the engineering and in the commercial industries in the region. Like, if you're going to recruit and retain a job force, you gotta have things for people to do outside of work. And this is one of those things that has shown to be of value to people in the Dubuque County area are our parks, our trails, our natural spaces, our fishing, our kayaking, canoeing, biking, right? So we're out there right now raising money, building awareness, and building coalition among like-minded organizations like Tri-State Trails, Friends of the Dubuque County Conservation Board, Friends of the Mines of Spain, Pheasants Forever, Trout Unlimited. Yeah.
You going to get on with Cindy Coleman on KBTH for a...
I probably should. I should give Cindy a call. I was on Extension Council with Cindy when she was on the Extension Council. I'm still on Extension Council.
I mean, that's a good avenue for...
Yeah. we haven't really looked at radio yet. We have social media strategies. So in a campaign like this, from my understanding, and I'm learning, you know, I've never done anything like this before, so it's really cool. You know, you want to target those who are likely to vote. They need to know what's going to be on the ballot before they show up to vote or before they request an absentee ballot. So we have that list of people that will turn out for an election like this, and so we're just reaching out to them directly through mail. And then you have an audience that truly values outdoor recreation that maybe isn't on that list, and for the most part, those are going to be, you know, young professionals, single young professionals, young families who maybe don't have children in the school district yet, so maybe they're not going to show up for a school district election. Maybe they don't live in the city, so they're not going to show out for a city council election. So that is the strategy right now.
50%.
We need 60% in order for this to pass. And it's over 20 years. It authorizes the Board of Supervisors to bond for up to $40 million in the next 20 years. There's no like time frame as to, I mean, do they have to do it sooner? Do they have to spend a certain amount by a certain time? No. And is there any mandate that the Board of Supervisors actually has to do this? No. This is all about just giving them permission to do so.
Funding available.
And then it falls on the boards of the board or the shoulders of the supervisors to leverage or levy these bonds. And that'll be an interesting process once that starts as well.
I've always been amazed that there's only three people on the Board of Supervisors.
In Dubuque County, it's five in other counties.
I know.
But yeah.
I don't know if that's good or bad or whatever.
I think it's a nice balanced board as it is currently.
Yeah,
I like,
that's true.
Yeah. It's been great having Harley, I think, on the board and seeing him out in the community. He's, you know, he's at a lot of these field days in Bankston that I've been helping. Like, there are not my field days. Those are the Dubuque County Watersheds. Eric Schmeckel and his team are facilitating those. And, you know, Harley shows out in force and everybody knows who he is. Partially because he shows up wearing a white shirt and a white hat that says Harley Potthoff on it. I walked up to him last time I saw him, like, are you Harley Potthoff? And he just looked at me. But yeah, that might have been after a handful of Busch Lights too, because I think we were sitting in the Smith Farm in Bankston just drinking beers. Yeah, not Jack, his sons, the one right down from the O'Connells.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was fun.
Yeah, Jack's on my target list. I want to interview him. I went on the barn tour that he's involved with.
So that was his then. That's his boys, isn't it, that run that farm? That was his brother's farm, right?
Yeah.
That's where the field day was held, was in that barn.
Okay.
Those are Will. So Will Smith, I graduated with Will, and those are his brothers that run that farm now.
Okay.
Will's in New Zealand. Like, he's been living in New Zealand for as long as I can remember. Yeah. He and his wife moved to New Zealand, came back to the Twin Cities, and then went back to New Zealand. He lives in New Zealand. Elsa May, she lives in Australia.
Spread out.
All right.
Listen, I appreciate the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope this is what you were trying to get into.
Exactly.
I'll tell you, Western Dubuque, I...